welcome to a brand new episode of Calling It, recording Monday, February 1st, top of the 1 o'clock hour as the snow starts to come down here in Boston. It is blizzard season. I'm Alex Barth, joined by Alex Lebowitz. We're powered by CLNS Media. Lebowitz, you hunkered down there?
Yeah, it's not really, it's barely snowing. It's kind of flurrying where I'm at. Nothing's sticking yet. So I think we got a couple hours, at least in my neck of the woods, before things get too rough. But I'm staying home. I'm not going to be leaving the house till tomorrow morning.
I got a grocery run after this. And then, I'm kind of in the same boat. I'm going to be in place as well. Obviously, there's a lot to do. If you're sitting at home, you're scrolling Twitter, there's plenty to scroll through this week. It is Super Bowl week. Media Day is going on right now. It's kind of a bummer because Media Night, as it usually is like an awesome event. It's awesome and it's horrible at the same time. I went in 2019 when the Patriots played the Rams for the second time, and you get all these players, essentially one team goes at a time, but you get all these players in a big room. Like the year I went, it was at the Hawks Arena in Atlanta. The game was in Atlanta that year. It was on the floor of the Hawks Arena, and you just get – it's every kind of media. Like, there's no football discussed. There's very little football discussed. You have people in weird costumes. You have everybody trying to get the viral soundbite. It's like a zoo. So obviously not the same environment this year, but we got that today and then throughout the week, and then obviously the game on Sunday. This is only the second time in the history of the show we are not previewing a Patriots Super Bowl. It is the fourth time in the five-year history of the show. I think I did that math right. Let me go back through that in my head. Because there's the Eagles, the Rams, or the third time in the four-year history of the show. No, because the first year was the Falcons Super Bowl. Jump in here, Lebowitz. I'm making a mess of this.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, the first one that I joined in for...
It was only like a couple months without you. I started with the Falcons Super Bowl. So it would have been Falcons, Rams. They didn't make it. And then this one. So this would be the fourth. So this is the – of the 4 years I previewed the Super Bowl on this show, Tom Brady's been in three of them. Just pointing that out there. Anyway, I love what's – because I'm rambling right now. Your Super Bowl talk. This is why you don't do math live on the air, kid.
Yeah, either way, I think your point kind of just highlights Brady's – just talent and how dominant he's been despite being 43. And I know that's a talking point that we've made ad nauseum, but it's still worth recognizing. We're heading into yet another Super Bowl, and Tom Brady is going to be under center playing in his 10th one. Pretty wild. It was 18% of all Super Bowls Tom Brady has played in.
So the stat I like is more, it's with conference championships, but he's made 75% of all the conference championships he's been eligible for. The single season completion record, or sorry, the career completion record is 72%, which Breeze, I believe, oh no, Watson has it. So it's more likely that Tom Brady will make the conference championship game than any quarterback, including Tom Brady, will make a pass, will complete a pass. That's one of those stats. I love to use that stat to screw with the analytics nerds, because statistically, if you want to go by the numbers, which all these people want to do now in sports, which is stupid, statistically, Tom Brady can make the Super Bowl without completing a pass or make the conference championship. I'm all over the place with this. Lebowitz, keep going.
Yeah. I think the point is he's been incredibly dominant. And there are a bunch of statistics you could point to. 75% of the ones you're eligible for. That's just crazy. And then you have some idiots who are like, well, Joe Montana never lost in the Super Bowl, so that puts him above, blah, 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 blah. And that's just the dumbest point of all time. This guy has put himself and his team in a position to, fight for a championship pretty much every single year. They've had a shot. They've been contenders when he's on a football team. That you'll never see this again. You will never see this again. So I think the main storyline when you look at this game is obvious. You have the old school guy, the guy who's been in the league for over 20 years, 43 years old. Patrick Mahomes, I don't even think was in kindergarten when Brady got drafted, and he's going up against Tom Brady. So you have someone who I think is solidified, obviously the best football player, quarterback of all time, going up against somebody who has a very good shot at being the second best quarterback of all time when his career is said and done. I know he's only 25, but I don't think that's too far-fetched to say if he continues this trajectory. So that's the big thing. And that's, I think, the biggest storyline. It's great for the NFL. And I think it's fair to look back at this postseason and look at the matchups we've seen. And it's been pretty damn entertaining, given the fact that it's a COVID year. I think that, you know, these matchups, the competitions we've seen, the games that we've seen play out, it's gone very well. So I'm very excited for this game this weekend. And I think it's going to be a close one. I think it's going to be a really good game. I really do.
I mean, I think this is going to be a very interesting game in that both of these teams have started slow at times this year. And I think this is going to kind of look like one of those classic Big 12 games where, you know, there's maybe 7 points scored in the first quarter and both teams end up in the 40s. Like, I don't think that that's totally unrealistic. And I just look at it, you know, I don't want to pick against Tom Brady in the Super Bowl, but Tampa's in a rough spot in some sense. I don't think Ryan Jensen's a very good starting center. I think he's been the crux of a lot of their offensive problems. He's got to block Chris Jones. On the other side of the ball, both of Tampa's two safeties, if they play, I think Winfield's going to play. We don't know about Whitehead, but their two starting safeties are banged up. That's no bueno against the Chiefs. That's nightmare fuel against the Chiefs. And I just think that team's an absolute wagon right now. Mm-hmm. I also wonder if, you know, we saw this from the Bills last week, and we talked about this last week on the show when we recapped the championship round. Part of the Bills' problem was they went into Kansas City, and I don't think they recognized that they weren't the better team. I don't think they recognized that they needed to do some things differently because their opponent was so much better than them. I do think, or I wonder if the Bucs are going to be able to recognize that, because the Chiefs are a better team. And I wonder if with Tom Brady at the helm, and Brady's done it before. He did it against the Chiefs in 2018 in that championship game. But I wonder if Tom Brady and the Bucs and their bonehead head coach, Bruce Arians, are going to be able to recognize they're not the better team in this game.
Yeah, I and they got to cater the game to what their strengths are and just try to limit the Bucs as much, the Chiefs as much as possible. And, you know, the two safeties being questionable for this one, it's huge when you're playing a team that has the speed that the Chiefs have. I think another factor that plays the Bucs' advantage, however, is Eric Fisher. He's done. He's out. That's one of the top linemen for the Chiefs. And, you know, I know Patrick Mahomes, he's mobile. It's not going to be easy to try to, you know, get in his head to stifle him in any regard. But that helps a lot. And I think the Bucs' defense is better than a lot of people give him credit for. That said, they're going up against an offense they've never played before, one that's, you know, going to be very difficult to match up against. But going up against Aaron Rodgers is a pretty good run through. So, you know, I think it's going to be tough. I think, you know, Patrick Mahomes is going to make his plays, obviously. But I think it's going to be close. And another reason I think that is you have Brady going up against a team in the Super Bowl that he has a lot of experience against. He has a lot of experience not only against the Chiefs, but against Andy Reid, stemming back to, you know, obviously the first Eagles Super Bowl with the Patriots. And you got to give the advantage in that regard to a guy like Brady, who kind of will know what to look for, especially considering the fact that he has a lot of weapons to work with. And I think he's going to know how to attack this Chiefs defense. But you mentioned it. That offensive line is going to be the most important factor for the Buccaneers coming into this one. The way you stop Tom Brady, the way you get in his head, the way you stifle him is by rushing him, by making him uneasy in that pocket. And if they don't accomplish that, then at the very least, you're looking at a shootout. And at the worst for the Chiefs, you're looking at a pretty decisive victory for the Buccaneers. So everyone's picking the Chiefs in this one. I've been riding the Bucs. I think Tom Brady, there is that X factor with him. It is real. And this is a game in which he has familiarity against his opponent. They're practicing at home. They're at their home venue. And I don't want to weigh that too much, but it's a factor. So when I look at all this, I look at the narrative, the storyline. I think I'm picking the Bucs in this one. I think it's going to come down to the fourth quarter, but I'm picking the Bucs.
You know what? Everything tells me that I should pick the Chiefs, but I can't get it out of my head that it comes down to it late in the game, and you have the greatest late game performer in all time in Tom Brady, in a coach who, yes, has gotten better recently, but has historically been a late game mess in Andy Reid. So, you know, I think generally the better quarterback wins the Super Bowl. And as good as Brady's played this year and he's looked good, Mahomes is the better quarterback in this game. Not all time. Let me just, because some people are confusing that.
Of course, yeah.
But currently, Patrick Mahomes is number one. I have Brady probably about, he's probably the fifth best quarterback in the league this year, fourth or fifth. There was a clear top three, I think, in Mahomes, Aaron Rodgers, and Deshaun Watson. I think after that, you get into Josh Allen, you get into Russell Wilson, and you can split hairs here and there. But Mahomes was the second best quarterback in football this year. He is the best quarterback in this game. I'm going to go with the quarterback. But I don't feel good about it. I wouldn't put any money on this game or anything like that. It's going to be a really close game. It's going to be a really good game, and that's kind of all you can ask for at this point. So,
absolutely. Yeah, I agree. I think it's going to be – I think whatever happens, because I don't feel confident that the Bucs are going to win. I'm picking them to win. But you mentioned it. It's because it's going to come down to the fourth quarter, and you say you're going with the better quarterback, and I 100% agree. Patrick Mahomes right now is the better quarterback, but he's not – the better late game quarterback. I think you still have to give that title to Brady. Point. That said, we saw the second half against the Packers in the NFC Championship game. And
yeah, he can't do that. You can't turn the ball over three times against the Chiefs. You can't give the Chiefs one extra possession. Forget three.
And the turnover battle is going to be huge. Because they decisively won the turnover battle against the Saints and almost, you know, and that was a game. It shouldn't have been as close as it was, but it was pretty close. And then you go up against the Packers, and really what won them that game was poor coaching, horrible play calling from the opposition. I think Andy Reid's a better coach than LaFleur. That said, taking care of the football is going to be very important, and consistency all four quarters, coming out hot and making sure that plateau come that second half. It's going to be a good one, but he's a big game performer, Tom Brady, and this is as big as it gets. Legacy-wise, it's big. I know he solidified it, but still the up-and-comer or the guy who's already here, top-notch, best player in the league against the best of all time. It's really awesome. I think we're going to look back at this game for a while in awe.
All right, let's get on to there was actually other pretty big NFL news this week. Obviously not as big as the Super Bowl, but you know, there's always that one story besides the Super Bowl that dominates Super Bowl week. I remember the year that I was there. That was when the first whispers really came out about Kyrie wanting out of Boston. Well, I'm trying to remember what it was last year. It was something stupid last year. But anyway, there's always one
last
story.
Last year there was a Kobe Bryant.
You're right. That's what it was. Yes. It was all about Kobe Bryant. No, you're absolutely right. I don't know what I was thinking of. The stupid story. That might have been the year before. So what would have been
one of those two.
there's always weird stuff that dominates week four. But this year, I think one of the ones could very well be the Matthew Stafford trade, which happened Saturday night. He gets traded to the Rams for Jared Goff, two firsts and a third. We'll start off with this. Oh, which side do you want to start on, Lebowitz? Do you want to start on the Lions or the Rams?
We can start on the Rams side.
Okay, so here's the interesting thing about what the Rams did. And I can't tell if I like this trade for them. I don't love it for them. They have to win a Super Bowl now because the Rams' last first round pick was Jared Goff in 2016. They haven't made a first round pick since. And after that trade, they won't make another one until at least 2024.
Mm.
This team has gone all out. They're essentially now the Brooklyn Nets of the NFL. And if they turn this into a Super Bowl, which I think they can, the window's tiny. It's this year, maybe next year. I don't know the full state of all their contracts. I think that they're going to have to pay Aaron Donald in that window. But if they win a Super Bowl, it's great. You know, you get your one Super Bowl, you get your chip, and there you go. But they are certainly willing to just kind of send it. And they get the Jared Goff contract off the books, and that's certainly good. But, man, you talk about mortgaging a future, big-time mortgaging their future. They can make a run. They realistically can make a run. They will have – you know, it's not like they're going to have to go through Mahomes to get to the Super Bowl. They probably won't have to go through Deshaun Watson to get to the Super Bowl. Rodgers is up there. Brady's up there. So they're in position. The NFC is relatively open in the immediate future. But if they don't get a ring, they're going to be bad for a while after this.
Yeah, it's a gamble. There's no doubt about it. But I, you need a quarterback, and they did not hit on Jared Goff. Jared Goff's a good quarterback. He's not worth, you know, where they picked them.
I don't think Jared Goff's a good quarterback. So keep in mind here,
mm-hmm.
Jared Goff was not, this was not like, oh, we got two picks and Jared Goff. Like, this is the Lions perspective I wanted to get into. This was, we got a first rounder for Matthew Stafford, and we got another first rounder for agreeing to take on Jared Goff's horrible contract. Yeah. Jared Goff is not, you know, a part of this trade. He's a throw-in.
So, yeah. So he's, I mean, listen, and when I say good, I mean, he's in that, you know, 15 to 20 range.
I don't know. I put him with Garoppolo. I put him down there in the low 20s.
Maybe he's in the 20s. Either way, he's a starting quarterback in the NFL. I think that's so there's a lot of teams that he'll be able to start for. And the Lions are obviously included in that. Point being, he was not a hit. The Rams did not hit on that deal. The guy got to the Super Bowl, but it was a little fluky, as we saw. And he couldn't really get it done when it came down to it. So they parted ways with him with somebody who not only is a much better quarterback, but has some moxie, has some attitude, I think, and can add an edge on that offense that Goff just was not fulfilling. So that's big. When it comes down to the first round pick and the history of the Rams doing that, I think it might have been you or Evan Lazar who brought this point up on Twitter, but I agree. I think there are a lot of teams that might overvalue those 20 to 30 range in the draft, 20 to 32 range in the draft, just because it's a first round pick. And it's not always a hit. We've seen that here in New England. So if you can trade two of those picks for a guy who's going to, you know, be reliable at your most important position, while also getting rid of a contract that is going to stifle your team from, you know, a free agency standpoint, that's a problem. And I mean, that's a pretty fair solution. And if you're the Lions, you easily take it because they're not, you know, trying to win now. They're building for their future. So I think this is a mutually beneficial trade. And I know a lot of people were shocked at what was given up to get Stafford. But again, you need production at that position. And the Rams, you look at the guys that they've taken in with those first round picks. I mean, Jalen Ramsey, you're telling me he's not worth a first round pick or two? He's one of the best cornerbacks in the league. He's a lockdown guy. Stafford, you know, he's a top 10, top 15 quarterback in the league, somebody who you can rely on and somebody who's tough as hell. And, you know, I think you're going to, you know, risk those picks for sure things anytime. I think Brandon Cooks are one exception of that not working out for them. But either way, I'm for it on both ends. I think the Lions got a great haul for that guy. I'm happy for Matt Stafford for going to a really good team as well. And again, the Rams have their guy and they are a contender next year. They're definitely a team I could see a lot of people picking to win the championship, especially if he fits in with that offense, which I imagine he will.
Yeah. I don't think a lot of people realize how good Stafford is. And a lot of that's on the Lions. I mean, his career arc doesn't reflect the player he is. He's a top 10 quarterback. The Rams got a top 10 quarterback and they're in business. And again, they got to win it for this to kind of be worth it. But, and then on the other side, like you mentioned, I do like where the Lions are at. Cause basically you have two more years before you can get rid of Goff's contract. There's four more years on it, but it's dead. The dead money is $30 million this year, next year. And then it goes down to eight. And then the last year is one. So you can get out of those pretty easily, but they're going to be bad this year. They're going to be really bad, but that's kind of what you want. And then they have all the ammunition now. They have the seventh round pick this year and two first round picks in each of the next 2 years. I don't think they make all those picks. They'll eventually package them, trade up, and go get the quarterback they want. They'll basically have their pick. They're, you know, I compared the Rams to the Nets. The Lions are the Celtics in this situation. So we'll see how that goes. And then, of course.
Or the Rockets.
That's a good one. We'll see what happens with the Rockets. Like, the Celtics figured it out. We don't know that the Rockets are going to figure it out, right?
That's fair.
And then the other side of this is we find out the next day that Matthew Stafford told the Lions they could trade him anywhere but New England. Everybody makes a big deal about it. I don't see it as a big deal. And here's why. I said from the beginning, I didn't think Matthew Stafford would want to come to the Patriots. I didn't think they'd be the only team he didn't want to come to. But I didn't think he'd want to come here. And, you know, there's a number of reasons. He's in the twilight of his career. He doesn't know who he's throwing the ball to. People saying, oh, you go get him Aaron Robinson. You can't guarantee him a free agent. And then I think the Patricia thing is a big deal. And it's not so much direct interaction with Matt Patricia, right? Matt Patricia's the assistant to the head coach. He's going to be working on special projects. You know, he's not going to be around on a day-to-day basis. But Matt Patricia just Matthew Stafford basically just spent the last 3 years watching Matt Patricia do a bad Bill Belichick impersonation, which by all accounts was ugly in Detroit. Patricia was totally unhinged, and he thought he was doing the Patriot way, and he wasn't. But, you know, if you're Matthew Stafford and you look at that and you hated it, by all accounts, he hated it. You know, it's hard not to look at that and say, okay, if he's ripping off Bill Belichick, how close was he to the real thing? And if it's remotely close, do I want to put myself through that again? And I don't blame him for not wanting to do it. So that's logical. You know, people are saying that New England's no longer a destination and players don't want to come play for Belichick and it was all about Brady. Like, yes, and like there's truth to that and there isn't. Players wanted to come to New England to play with Brady because they knew they'd have a chance to win a Super Bowl. If Belichick gets the team competitive again, they'll have a shot at free agents. It's not that players wanted to play specifically with Brady. I mean, they did, but they wanted a shot to win a Super Bowl. Belichick last year showed that that's not a given in New England anymore. But, you know, to think that the Patriots will never sign a free agent again, that they'll suddenly become the Celtics and become this black hole of free agency, I don't think is accurate either. I think Stafford not wanting to play in New England and having a strict no New England policy is more about his relationship and his experiences with Matt Patricia than it was an overarching indictment on the New England Patriots.
And I think, you know, I hate where these conversations go because it turns into, you see, Brady was the real reason for the success. When this is zero indication of anything besides Matthew Stafford's preferences. And it, if anything, you could argue that this is really an indictment on Stafford because, I mean, how the hell do you not want to play with Belichick? I don't understand that. I think that there has been a lot of disrespect for Belichick simply because it's, you know, a hot take and that seems to be the new wave.
But again, why would he? Why outside of just he's Bill Belichick? Remember, Bill Belichick went 7-9 last year. Why would he? Who's he throwing the ball to?
You could argue that the Patriots going 7-9 and being on the doorstep of beating teams like the Bills and the Chiefs, like they could have easily gone 9-7, 10-6.
But I'm not calling the record an indictment on Belichick. I'm not looking at the record and saying Belichick can't coach. I'm looking at it and saying here's a guy who has 2 or 3 years left in the NFL. He's never really been in a playoff game. I think he played in one and it was incredibly lopsided. Mm-hmm. How do you, even with Bill Belichick, how do you look at the current state of the Patriots and think that that's the team that's going to get me there?
Well, logically, they have
a team as opposed to a team like the Niners or as opposed to a team like, you know, Washington, who also has better receivers.
But that's not the discussion. I think that's completely irrelevant because the Patriots were the only team on his no trade list. And clearly there are worse teams to be on in the NFL than the Patriots. So I don't think it had anything to do with personnel from a roster standpoint. I think it reflects entirely on Matt Patricia and Stafford's perception of, you know, quote unquote, the Patriot way and Bill Belichick. I think you hit the nail on your head on the head in regard to, you know, he looks at Bill Belichick as a Matt Patricia type and he doesn't want to play for a guy like that, which I think is narrow minded. And I think that's ignoring the context and the legacy and, you know, what Belichick has done to accrue the respect that he has throughout the league and the title of greatest head coach of all time. So I think it has nothing to do with the roster, maybe a small portion, but it's more about, you know, that coaching staff. To me, that's at least what it seems like, and specifically Matt Patricia. Either way, I think it's a dumb move. I mean, the Patriots, again, they have a lot of cap space. They have a great football coach. And say what you want about Matt Patricia, but he is pretty damn successful as a defensive coordinator for the Patriots. So maybe he's not a head coach, but he can be a defensive coordinator.
But when he talks about it after games, like, hey, you blew a late lead, and he goes, oh, Malcolm Butler, like,
of course,
yeah, I get
course.
Why he wouldn't want to be around that guy.
He's 100% a douche, but he also would tone that down for Belichick. He's not going to be saying shit like that when, you know, Bill Belichick is going to be, you know, going off on him afterwards, which he 100% would do. There's no doubt that the Rams is a much better situation for Matthew Stafford. It's a better roster, a better defense, a young coaching staff, a team that's, you know, been consistently decent over the past few years, despite underperforming at the quarterback position.
Who is he throwing the ball
to? Cooper Kupp. There's a bunch of guys.
I'm saying like if he were, cause you're still talking about him not wanting to come to New England. Like that has to be part of the conversation too.
Yeah, who's he throwing the ball to in New England? Yeah, I know, and I get that. But again, there's no other team on his list. Who's he throwing to the ball? Who's he throwing the ball to on any other team?
In that Washington, potentially... he's got Terry McLaurin. In Carolina, he's got Robbie Anderson. In San Francisco, he's got Kittle. He's got Ayuk. He's got Debo. Who else is on his list? In Denver, he's got Jerry Jeudy.
But surely there are teams that are not nearly as well situated. And you also have to consider the Patriots have a talented defense. Like, I think they have a good roster on that side of the ball. They have a good offensive line. The only glaring hole is, as you mentioned, skill position guys, you know, targets. But you can build that up to an extent. And if you have Edelman coming back and maybe you get one or two decent free agents, then you're on the same level as the teams you just mentioned, if not a higher level, because you will have the advantage when it comes to coaching. So I think, again, it's closed-minded to just look at it from that perspective, especially when you consider the cap space that this team has. I know that there's no guarantees that come with having cap space, but Matthew Stafford is a guy who will bring other guys in. He's an enticing figure, and he's a good quarterback. And I think there would be curiosity around the league from a player standpoint to see what a Patriots roster could do with a guy like Matthew Stafford. So obviously he didn't look at it that way. And he chose a team, or he signed off on going to a team that's going to be a great situation for him anyway. I guess I'm just saying it's weird that the only team on that list was the New England Patriots. And, you know, I think that could be a little bit of a red flag. I don't think we should be celebrating Matthew Stafford because it solidifies some people's takes that Belichick is looked at as, you know, a curmudgeon across the league. I think that's a poor reflection on Stafford personally.
I don't know. And then, like, everybody's compounding it with the Danny Amendola comments, which always – every time Danny Amendola trashes Belichick, he gets taken out of context. But, you know, he comes out today and says that the Patriot way was all Brady, blah, blah, blah. I mean, who do you think – first of all, who do you think made Brady that way? People go back to when Amendola called Belichick an asshole. They leave out the part of the quote where Amendola said, and it's all in the interest of making the team better. It's just, you know – you're right. This is more about Stafford and about Patricia than it is about Belichick, but it's going to get made about Belichick. And that's what makes this annoying.
Yeah, of course. Of course. And it's, and that's unfortunate. And you only hope that there aren't other players in the league, specifically at the quarterback position, that feel the same way. And I don't think there are. I think, you know, if you go through what Matthew Stafford went through, forget about the last 3 years throughout his career. He hasn't had a lot of support. Maybe he's had guys like Golden Tate and Calvin Johnson, and, you know, he's had a few players to work with. But from a coaching standpoint, there hasn't been much there. From a front office standpoint, there hasn't been much there. And the most recent one, you know, the most recent head coach was probably the most polarizing figure he's had to work with. And, you know, you talk about a guy's stock plummeting, you know, pun unintended with the GameStop stuff. But you talk about a guy's stock plummeting. I don't think anyone's stock has plummeted. Maybe Adam Gase is the one guy more so than Matt Patricia over the past few years, and he's made himself look like a jackass. And so I get Stafford not wanting to be a part of a team in which, you know, Patricia is a part of, you know, a lot of decisions, important decisions. So I get that. I do. I just think it's a little closed-minded, and you got to understand, you go to a team that's coached by Bill Belichick. That's the only guy you really have to worry about, especially if, you know, the guy you're trying to avoid isn't going to be doing much when it comes to offensive game plans and whatnot. You're going to be dealing with McDaniels. You're going to be dealing with Belichick. I don't think Patricia would be somebody he'd be he would have been associating with all that much. Either way, I digress. He's in a good situation. It worked out for him. I just find it curious. I find it curious that that's the one team that he decided not to go to.
You know, I also think there were 7-8 teams involved. We don't know, you know, how many teams were flat nose from the beginning. There might have been teams that, because by all the reports, basically, the Patriots were told he doesn't want to go there, and they said, we'll offer anyway. And the whole thing about this that makes it irrelevant is Stafford doesn't have a no-trade clause. Nothing would have happened if he was traded to the Patriots. He's not in a position where he can hold out. So it was kind of an empty gesture for him to say that. But, you know, we don't know. There might have been other teams that were going to offer, and the Lions said he doesn't want to play there. And then they just said, you know what? Fine. We won't deal with it. Right? Like, that's a possibility. Maybe like we saw something that the Jets, Breer had in his column this morning. The Jets briefly inquired. That, to me, means they checked in. They're, for whatever reason, it wasn't feasible, they checked out. They have the second overall pick. So I can't imagine it wasn't feasible because they didn't have the ammunition. So maybe there were other teams and the Patriots just decided they were the only one who Stafford didn't want to play for, who just decided to put their head down and say, yeah, we'll offer anyway. Or maybe it's, you know, they're the only team that has Patricia. So we'll see. You want to move on to baseball now? You ready for some baseball talk?
Yes, let's do it.
All right. Yet another long-tenured Boston athlete is stepping away. I don't know. Does Pedroia, can I describe it as stepping away when he essentially hasn't played in 3 years?
Yeah. I mean, he's been away.
He's been right. I think it's like 40 at-bats since 2017. Anyway, if you missed it, Dustin Pedroia announced his retirement this morning. Everybody kind of knew it was coming for some time, but here it is. Great player. Great player. It's a shame that the end of his career is going to kind of stick with him. I think the most symbolic thing about the end of his career is that his last at-bat, which was a pop-up at Yankee Stadium, dropped his average, career average, from 300 to 299, which is brutal.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty bad. And it kind of is a microcosm for the end of his career. It really is. I mean, you statistically, physically, I mean, he deteriorated. And it was sad to watch. It really was. He's a small guy, had a lot of heart, played tough, was respected in the clubhouse. And then he just didn't come to grips with, you know, the fact that his baseball mortality was present. And we can look back on 2017, Machado getting thrown out by Barnes and him saying, it wasn't me, I didn't direct that. Or maybe that's 2018. He did a lot of things towards the end of his career that I think left a sour taste in everyone's mouth. He wasn't the guy that could lead the clubhouse effectively once Ortiz retired. And I think that became the major talking point centered around Pedroia, which is super unfortunate because he's the typical guy, the gritty guy you want to respect. You know, he was undervalued out of college. He was somebody who, you know, scouts were not high up on. He was a risky pick in the draft at the time, and he ended up proving a lot of people wrong. And I think you look at the career he made for himself, and it's incredibly impressive. But yeah, I think you will never be able to talk about Dustin Pedroia and his legacy without discussing the lack of longevity and how at the end of his career he just was unable to come to grips that he wasn't the guy he used to be. He wasn't the player he used to be. And his attempts on coming back failed every single time. That said, he's made the right decision clearly. And I think the only criticism you can give him is it was a little too late. He should have hung up the cleats probably 2 years ago. It probably would have done a lot for his reputation. Either way, it's a career well worth celebrating. And he's somebody who was the most integral, you know, person throughout the past 15, 20 years for the Red Sox by a long stretch.
Yeah, I mean, he was on 3 World Series teams. He didn't play in 2018, really. I think he only played like 4 games, but he was technically a part of 3 World Series teams. He was drafted in 2004. So he was with the Red Sox for all of their World Series, although he was only there for half the year, low minors in 04, whatever. Anyway, a true like franchise cornerstone player. And we talked about this a little bit last week, right, with Dave Dombrowski, when we talked about Dave Dombrowski and Chaim Bloom and the differences. And I actually wrote about this last week. You can find the column on 98.5thesportshub.com that, you know, with the Red Sox, you trade a guy like Mookie Betts, Jackie Bradley Jr. is going to walk. You know, they really don't have that staple pitcher. This is a franchise that's short on cornerstone pieces. And the Red Sox, yes, are a team that should kind of be able to go from 0 to 100 and should be able to spend their way back into contention. But even those teams generally have some stability from year to year and guys that carry over and help get you through the lulls. And Pedroia really is. I mean, since Ortiz retired in 2016, he's a franchise cornerstone. He really was. And I don't know that the Red Sox have that right now. I think Xander Bogaerts is certainly on track, and he's now the longest tenured Red Sox at 28 years old, but he's only 28 years old. And I think he only has like 2 years left on that extension he signed. It seems like yesterday. So we'll see what happens with him. But the Red Sox, this should be, and it's not a surprise that he retired, but use this opportunity as a wake-up call. Before the Red Sox can get back to being dominant, they need to put the cornerstones in place. And they have Bogaerts. Vasquez is kind of there, but he's constantly rumored to be traded. And then who do you have after that? Eduardo Rodriguez is going to be a free agent after the season, unrestricted free agent. You can't really count on Chris Sale at this point. Matt Barnes is the longest tenured member of their bullpen, but it's Matt Barnes. I mean, do they, like, who are their cornerstones right now? That's where they need to get to before they can be truly World Series competitive again. And Pedroia wasn't going to fill that role this year. He wasn't going to play, but this is just another reminder that they're kind of missing that guy right now. And they don't, it's not easy, right? It's easy to sit here and say they need a cornerstone. Those guys don't come along every day. Mm-hmm. Those are the rarest of the rare players, but you should have one. You should kind of have one guy, and it goes from one to one to one and strings along, and you patch the torch. And maybe it's Bogaerts. We'll see. But the Red Sox really don't have a clear-cut guy for that right now.
I do think it's Bogaerts. I think, you know, I think he's probably more clear-cut that guy than you're giving him credit for.
It's not so much about – my issue is not so much about him. I'm going to pull up his contract here while you make that point. But it's like if they traded Mookie Betts, they'll do anything.
Yeah. I think with
it's kind of my point is more so it should have been, and you can have more than one, mm-hmm. right? And you should have like two or three guys like that, right? It was Pedroia, it was Ortiz, and you know, then they had
Lester,
right?
Before they botched that.
But even from Lester, then it kind of carried over, and you know, you a guy like Eduardo Rodriguez who has been here for a little bit, and mm-hmm. and they had John Lackey who kind of hung around. And was sort of that guy, as weird as he was sometimes. But, you know, you trade Mookie Betts. Actually, Bogaerts' contract's much longer than I thought it was. It runs through 2026, and it's pretty hard to get out of. So Bogaerts is that guy. But, like, let's see. Go get a cornerstone pitcher, right? Go get a cornerstone outfielder, and then we can talk. But it's just kind of a reminder of that.
And maybe, you know, J.D. Martinez was horrible last year. But let's not forget, before that, he was a damn good hitter. And he's somebody who I think can return to closer to that form than what we saw last season. But it would have been Mookie Betts, obviously. That would have been the guy. I think Devers definitely has that potential. And I think Bogaerts is that guy now. Pitching, you know, their rotation, obviously. Sale would ideally be that person, but he can't stay on the field. So,
I mean, it should be Rodriguez. But who knows what's going to happen with his
presence. Yeah, and they should probably prioritize trying to extend him because they can't be without a reliable pitcher, somebody who can stay somewhat, although he can't even stay healthy as is. So, I don't know. I think the main thing with this Pedroia retirement, though, is you know, it's the official end of that Red Sox era as we knew it. You mentioned it. He was retired, or he was drafted in 2004. He's been here pretty much since the start. It was him and Ortiz, and you know, both of them are now gone officially, which is kind of sad. It's similar to Brady leaving to an extent, not quite as traumatic, but it has to cause you to reflect and, you know, think about the makeup of those teams, number one, and the legacies of those guys who were a part of those teams. And there's definitely a different feel. This is a whole turned over team. You have a new manager. You have a new front office. You know, Lucchino's not really involved anymore. And there's a lot more turnover, it seems. And I think you're right there. I think you don't have the guys who you can look at as solidified Red Sox. I think really, Bogaerts is that guy right now, and that's about it. But one thing's for sure. Dustin Pedroia, you know, he was a Red Sox. He was a guy who really personified the teams that he was on, especially go back to like 2013 and the role he played there. He's been highly respected for good reason for the most part, you know, with the exception of the last few years of his career. And that's, again, well worth celebrating. I think, you know, we want to dive into like who's the next Pedroia, who's that next guy. I don't know if you get a guy like that. I mean, he was an undersized, you know, tough, scrappy player who went rookie of the year, then MVP in back-to-back seasons, made multiple all-star games, and was as good of a defensive second baseman as you'll ever see. So he was just electric to watch. I think more than anything, here it is. Here's the take. I think more than anything, you're not going to get a player who's as electric as both a David Ortiz and a Dustin Pedroia. I think they were two guys who were in their own category when it comes to that. And it's sad. And I think we forget that Pedroia was electric. Watching him play second base was as enjoyable as watching any player at their respective position play defensively. It was really a spectacle, especially considering how undersized he was. And I think, you know, it's something that I've already missed the past couple years, but now it's going to be a more permanent thing. So sad to watch, but a guy who I think one day will absolutely have his number retired at Fenway Park.
Oh, absolutely. And I want to get more into his legacy in a second, but one last point I want to make, kind of in the tradition that's been, you know, Pierce and Garnett, right? When they left, you get all those draft picks, and it helped the Celtics out tremendously. One kind of parting gift Pedroia's had, and this was part of the reason people thought he wouldn't retire, is that if he retired, he walked away, right? He signed that 8-year, $110 million contract back in 2014, and if he retired, he just walked away from the money. At the same time, the Red Sox weren't about to Bobby Bonilla him and defer the payments over 20 or 30 years, whatever it was. And this is – Sean McAdam reported this. I've actually seen a couple people report it. This would have been the last year of that deal, of Pedroia's 8-year contract that he signed in 2014. He was scheduled to make $12.1 million. The Red Sox are just going to pay him that this year. It does count against the luxury tax and all that. But after that, I think there's $2 million deferred yearly from a different contract. But essentially, Pedroia's off the books after that. And that's big for the Red Sox, that they didn't have to defer this contract and that they are going to be able to get it off the books in the amount of time it was supposed to come off the books. So that's big for them, and that's big, and it's good for Pedroia too, because he's getting his money. And you know, they could have deferred it. They could have deferred it. They could have potentially voided it and not paid him and left him that $12 million short. And you know, obviously he's made enough money to last multiple people a lifetime, but you know, he provided a service that was worth that much money, and he's going to get compensated for it.
Yeah.
So good for Pedroia and the Red Sox.
And I wonder, you know, is he going to go into, you know, broadcasting? Is he going to go into coaching? I'm always curious with guys like that.
So I'm actually
a future.
It's both. Funny, because I was wondering that too. And I can still see him as a coach, right?
But
his press conference actually going on right now. We'll do breaking news on the pre-recorded podcast. So he said he had a knee replacement in September, and he can't run anymore. So I wonder, you know, if you can't move, can you coach? Like, in the sense that, you know, is he going to be able to show what he needs to show his players? So maybe there's like a scouting role for him or something like that. But
if Jack McKean can do it, if Tony La Russa can do it. I mean, those guys, I don't think they can really showcase what needs to be done. So, I don't know. And I bet, yeah, he could still move around more. Like, he have a knee replacement. You can still bend over. He just – the day in and day out grind probably is what stopped him from returning. But, yeah, I don't know. I'd like to see him – I think he's more likely to become a broadcaster. Again, I point to that season in which he – you know, blame Matt Barnes for throwing at Machado. It rubbed me the wrong way. And I see him as somebody who is probably going to be doing something similar to Ortiz and Pedro.
Well, I mean, I'm sure Nesson has a seat open for him. I mean, they find everybody. They bring everybody back. So,
yeah,
you know, at least as a ramp
too up. Too many people sometimes.
I could see him getting to, you know, MLB Network or ESPN eventually. But, you know, if that starts, it probably starts at Ness, and I assume they love to have him. And then the question becomes, and we're kind of up against it here, so we're going to try to have this very complicated discussion somewhat quickly. Is he a Hall of Famer? And I'll go back to what I said before. That last at bat at Yankee Stadium, that pop out that dropped his career average down to 299. That's brutal, because he's not a 3,000 hits guy. He doesn't have massive home run numbers. The 300 average was going to go a long way for him. And I know it really shouldn't be a difference, but it's one of those things that's superficial, but it makes a difference to say a guy's a 300 hitter.
Yeah. I don't think he has. He'll get past the first round, the first ballot. I think he'll be somebody who sticks around on the ballot.
Sure.
But he's not even at 2,000 hits. So you look at if he remained consistent and he did, you know, what he did from 07 to 2015, if he did that for five more years, he's in the Hall of Fame. I think for sure. There's no question about it. Not first ballot guy, but he gets in eventually. And it's clear that at the peak of his game, he's a Hall of Fame caliber guy, especially when you talk about how well-rounded he is as a player, you know, defensively, offensively, he can do it all. But he just didn't play long enough. He's not a guy who played long enough. Again, his number will be retired at Fenway Park. He'll be in the Red Sox Hall of Fame. He's always going to be looked at with high respect, you know, in regard to his legacy and what he was able to accomplish. But he just unfortunately didn't have enough years, you know, strung together where he could get over that hump. So, no, I don't think he's making it.
Well, I think... Some of it too, like I don't think he's making it either. But is the Hall of Fame really about baseball anymore? He's a guy who played hard, was never linked to PEDs, and had a ton of fans in the media. And doesn't that seem more relevant at this point? Right? Barry Bonds is the say what you will about him. On paper, right? I talked about it, it's superficial and people like to hump the stats, but Droy is not a 300 hitter because he's 299. Barry Bonds has the most home runs of anybody in the history of the game. That is the trademark play of baseball, a home run. That is the shining moment of baseball, is the home run. And he did that more times than anybody else. Roger Clemens won 7 Cy Youngs. He won 2 of them 18 years apart. That's Tom Brady territory. 18 years apart. He won 2 Cy Youngs. 7 total, most ever. He's not in. Pete Rose, the most hits ever. He's not in. Like, does it matter anymore? Well, and then you can go down the Schilling road, and that's another thing. But we're not putting good players in the Hall of Fame anymore. We're just not doing that. So what does it matter?
Yeah, but you got to look at the context. I mean, you look at, yeah, obviously, it's steroids. I mean, that's the reason why Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds aren't in the Hall of Fame. Curt Schilling, it's because I honestly think he's, like, realistically closer to a borderline Hall of Famer than people are saying. But, I mean, it's clear that the person he is, the way he acts, and how he's treated the media has played a role in him not making it yet. I think he makes it next year.
At this point, it feels like we're closer to voting people out of the Hall of Fame than we are to voting them in. The character clause is vague. I get there's a character clause, but it's vague. And it's not supposed to be the ultimate decider. It's not the Hall of Fame of very good people. It's not. There's a ton of terrible, terrible people in the Hall of Fame, right? If this is the route baseball wants to go and the writers want to go, they need to vote out Ty Cobb. Who was the one that
Carlton
tweeted about?
Steve Carlton.
Steve Carlton, right. They need to vote out Steve Carlton. Who was
one of the wildest tweets ever, by the way.
That was unreal. Mickey Mantle. Was Mickey Mantle the one who was like a notorious drunk and he beat his wife left and right?
I don't know about the wife. I know he was definitely a partier.
One of those Yankees guys was a notorious drunken wife beater. Like, if you want to start voting people out and hammer home the character clause, you can do that, but you don't get to pick and choose. And if the character clause is equal, right? Because what they're basically saying right now is the character clause is as relevant as the pure baseball output. If that's the case, Brock Holt is a first ballot Hall of Famer. By all indications, like, the best guy. If we're going to weigh the character clause as much as the production, Dustin Pedroia should be in the Hall of Fame.
Well, I think it's important to note that a couple things. Curt Schilling, If he has
lunatic,
300,
horrible person.
Yeah, but that's not the direction I'm going. If he has 300 wins, or if he has 270 wins instead of, I think he's at 216 now, he's in the Hall of Fame already. If Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds don't have steroids attached to their names, they're clearly in the Hall of Fame. If Pete Rose doesn't have the gambling stuff, he's clearly in the Hall of Fame. So
can we go back to Schilling real quick?
Yeah.
Because you're making a good point, but I just want to point out, I don't think anybody's campaigning for Schilling for the Hall of Fame solely on his regular season statistics. He's the greatest postseason pitcher of all time. That's what puts him over the top.
He's absolutely, yeah. And I get that. But again, if he doesn't have that postseason success, I don't think people are really talking about it. Although he was 3,000 strikeout guy.
He was. He did have the postseason success. You can't say if he didn't. He did. It happened. There's nothing that says you can't use postseason success in consideration. If anything, you should lean on it.
Sure. And I agree.
He also, by the way, if you want to use the regular season numbers, across the board, better pitcher than Mike Mussina, who's in.
Yes. Well, Mike Mussina has more wins, regular season wins all time.
That's strikeouts, 20 win seasons, strikeouts, walk ratio, whip, everything. Everything outside of the individual win stat, which we now know really does not accurately reflect how well a pitcher pitched. Other stat is Schilling.
Yeah. And I agree. Schilling should be in the Hall of Fame. I think it's ridiculous he's not. I think there's a better argument to be made for guys like Pete Rose, Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens not being in the Hall of Fame. And also, to bring this back to Pedroia, he just doesn't have the numbers. The Hall of Fame is – baseball in general is such a historically motivated sport, and it's about legacy. It's about tradition. I saw a quote yesterday. It was from some show, and it's baseball is – a museum disguised as a sport. And I think that's a great way to put it, because so much is harped on with tradition. It's one of the reasons why people are so against shortening the regular season, because you mess with that stuff. You can't compare players, statistically the way you normally would if you had that consistency. Point being, Dustin Pedroia just doesn't have the numbers. He didn't have the longevity. Good player, not great player. And I also think there's an argument to be made that the Hall of Fame, not only in the MLB, but you can look at every Hall of Fame in professional sports, they're just not exclusive enough. So I don't think Pedroia belongs. I think if he's in, I think that minimizes the Hall of Fame to a degree.
But like Omar Vizquel's getting 50% of the vote.
Yeah. And Omar Vizquel shouldn't get in either.
I would say he's like on – people think Vizquel's going to get it. He's on Vizquel's level. Absolutely.
Yeah. I think the thing that separates Vizquel is he's the best defensive shortstop of all time.
Fair enough.
And he played for a really long time. And also, he's somebody who's still involved with the game. He's been on coaching staffs, I think, ever since he retired.
Do you know my Omar Vizquel tick?
No. What is it?
Omar Vizquel's just Derek Jeter with worse luck. Omar Vizquel is if Derek Jeter didn't get drafted.
He didn't have 3,000 hits. He wasn't.
Jeter shouldn't have played those last 2 years. He was a tourist attraction at that point. If Omar Vizquel is a lifelong Yankee, he gets to play long enough to get to 3,000 hits. Also, Omar Vizquel could move to his left. Derek Jeter wasn't good, but, take two players that have the exact same career. One plays for the Yankees, the other's a journeyman primarily on small market teams. They have the exact same career. Who gets more Hall of Fame votes?
The Yankee, obviously. But,
even though they were the exact same player, is my point.
But let's comparing Omar Vizquel to Pedroia, just because I'm looking at the numbers, and I wasn't aware he had this many hits. He finished his career with just about 2,900 hits.
Oh, all right.
That's right on the cusp. And again, he had the longevity. How many? He had at least double.
So again,
double
if he's a lifelong 11 Yankee, gold they, definitely, they definitely milk him to 3,000 hits.
Oh, if he's on the end. Yeah, sure. I agree. But I think there's more. I would honestly argue that there's more of a case for Omar Vizquel being a Hall of Famer with Dustin Pedroia.
So I will, because you gave me a quote, I'll give you this quote here as we wrap this up. And this isn't about Pedroia. This is just about in general to kind of go back to what we're talking about. This was Tom Fornelli writes for CBS Sports. I thought this was brilliant. This was the night that they announced nobody was getting in. I want to thank the brave gatekeepers of the Baseball Hall of Fame for protecting us all from baseball players being in the Baseball Hall of Fame. And, I think, and then he says a thread, and he says a little later on, the same morons who left their ballots blank as some sort of badge of honor are going to write columns about how MLB needs to make the game more marketable to a younger generation. And
bingo, bingo. There's
a huge truth in that. You know what? Until today, when they announced MLB The Show is going to be on Xbox, which amazing. But before that, you know what's gotten me more excited for baseball than anything in the last 3 years?
I think that I know what you're going to say.
That McGuire Sosa 30 for 30.
Oh, okay.
What did you think I was going to say?
I thought you were going to bring Ken Griffey Jr.
Oh, you know what? Throw the Griffey doc in there, too. I forgot about that. Throw the Griffey doc in there, too, because here's why. I got a chance to relive my childhood baseball memories, and it made me nostalgic for the game. You know what happens when you put somebody in the Hall of Fame? Their highlights are put all over Twitter, all over SportsCenter. You see their stats. People reminisce. It draws people back in. You're not allowing us a chance to – you're not allowing us – you have a chance. You, the baseball writers, the people who want to save the game, you have a chance to remind us why we love the game. You have a chance to bring us back. And out of some badge of moral obligation, you're not taking that opportunity, because these baseball writers would rather see the game die the way it is than live with some changes. So that's why I think get off. And I've said this before on the show a million times. There's no moral high ground in sports. Sports fans are not allowed to have moral high ground. At some point, in some way, we've all either rooted for a bad person or secretly been happy about an injury or something like that.
Yeah.
There's no moral high ground in sports. If you have moral high ground in sports, you're lying to yourself. You're kidding.
Enough
with the moral high ground.
I'll also say this, just to wrap this up. You know, I think there should be a discussion of changing the way we vote for Cooperstown.
Sure.
You ask players in the MLB, current players or former players. I would say at least, at the very least, 85% of these players who are still around who have played in the MLB for, you know, a relatively extensive amount of time would say Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds and Curt Schilling are all Hall of Fame baseball players. They would. They would 100% say that. If they had a vote, they would vote that way. But the gatekeepers through Cooperstown, I think they have a really hard time, you know, balancing between the traditionalist view that has dominated baseball writers forever. They have a hard time balancing that with trying to, you know, keep people invested in the game. They have an obligation to keep people invested in the game. They might not look at it that way, but they do. And, you know, I think you're spot on. You don't allow these guys to be in the Hall of Fame. You're making this, you know, there's a balance. I know I said it should be more exclusive, but Not because, you know, I'm not exclusive enough. Not exclusive enough to keep guys like Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens out of Cooperstown. Right. I mean, it's ridiculous. It really is. And at some point we can talk about, you know, MLB, the powers that be not being good at marketing athletes and you know, not catering to younger people as much.
They've had a huge week. They hired Griffey, which was big. They're putting MLB The Show out for Xbox. This is the first time I think they've ever done two good things in a week.
But it's been offset by, you know, this streak mark for baseball, which is, you know, old school, traditionalist points of view. That mindset is holding the game back. And that's directly what contributed to, no one getting inducted into Cooperstown this year. Baseball needs a major culture change. The median age is like 58, 59 years old for the average MLB team. More fans keep dying off, and that's not a good thing. So, you know, I really hope that this you know, league turns around. I really hope that the sport turns around, because it's not heading in a good direction, and I'm worried for it. Baseball is my first love for sports. You know, I started watching because of Pedro Martinez. Who's Pedro Martinez right now? There is none. And part of the reason is because they're not marketing guys well enough to create a Pedro-like guy. Maybe there isn't a person with that mindset. Who knows? Either way, there's a lot left to be desired, and there's a lot of room for improvement. And I don't know how you could be following this league for, you know, decades and not see it that way. It's just sad.
I think the answer is you get rid of the blank ballot. You do. Because in theory, the blank ballot is counterproductive to the point of the Hall of Fame. The Hall of Fame is supposed to be about, you know, It's not necessarily – it is and it isn't the best players of all time. It is the best players of all time, but it's also supposed to be a timeline. So even if one era is weaker, you still should honor the best players of that era because they still rose above and beyond. So when you have a blank ballot, you're essentially saying nobody in this era stood out. And that to me is false. So get rid of the blank ballot and enforce the issue because, you know – it's easy to not vote for Barry Bonds if you don't have to vote for anybody. I think it's going to be a lot harder for some of these writers, both internally and externally, you know. So you voted for Jeff Kent,
you vote not for Barry Rowland.
Bonds. Yeah. Right, you voted for Scott Rowland, but not Barry Bonds. Like, it's going to make these protest votes a lot harder for these writers to justify. So that's what I would do. If you turn in a blank ballot, you're suspended from voting the year after that.
And we're way over right now, but one more point to be made. Yeah. And this one's also been made a bunch of times, but I think it's a spot on take. The reason the steroid era was as big of a problem as it was due to people turning a blind eye to what was going on and enabling.
Well, no, the reason it was a problem is they stopped turning a blind eye.
You mean they acknowledged that it was a problem?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. They should just let it keep going. Do what every other sport does. Like, did you see these guys in the NFL? Like, they're not doing something. Just let it happen.
Well, you can't because you're risking athletes' health, and it's not healthy for these guys to go from, you know,
but here's the thing. It was never illegal. They didn't test for it.
So my point is they knew it was going on. And then they acted all high and mighty after the fact and overpunished players and destroyed legacies based off of, you know, a problem in which the MLB directly enabled. And who was the commissioner then? Bud Selig. Who is in the Hall of Fame right now?
Yes.
Bud Selig. He was inducted into Cooperstown, even though he was probably the most crucial figure to the rise of steroids in baseball due to his turning a blind eye. But he's in Cooperstown, but the guys who used it to keep their job, you know, in a league in which probably 80 to 90% of the players were taking some sort of performance-enhancing drug, they can't be in, but that guy who allowed it to go on can be. It's completely hypocritical. It's completely missing the point, and it is another indication as to how so many baseball writers who vote on these ballots have their heads really far up their asses.
Yeah, and I mean, we'll see what happens next year, but I think there needs to be some reform. All right, real quick here before we close it, because this has been my focus for the last 5 days. We have to talk about what's going on in the stock market, Lebowitz. I never thought we'd talk stonks on this show, but so basically really, really quick version, not even because we're up against it, but because it's super complicated. I knew nothing about how the stock market worked. Basically, I kind of saw this in the news, peripheral vision. I texted my friends. I said, because, you know, the new Xbox just came out. I said, like, if I wanted to make $700 in a day on the stock market right now, could I do it? And they were like, maybe. So I read up on how this works. Basically, here's the story. Hedge funds, bad guys. They were at fault in 08. They do this thing where if there's a stock they think is going to go down, they borrow shares of the stock from somebody, sell them, wait 2 weeks for the price to go down, buy them back cheaper, and give them back with a little bit of interest to the person they borrowed them from. The person they borrowed them from makes money with the interest. The hedge fund makes a ton of money on the difference in the stock prices, and the common consumer lose because the overall value of the market goes down. The problem with that is if you are doing that and the stock price go, if you're a hedge fund and you're doing that and the stock price goes up, oh, by the way, I was supposed to say at the beginning, none of this is financial advice. I was told I have to be very clear about that. I am just somebody who does this for fun. None of this is financial advice. Anyway, if you are one of these hedge funds and you borrow a stock and it's called shorting the stock, right? And the price goes up, then you lose a ton of money because you have to buy those stocks back at whatever price they're at. So basically what happened is these guys on Reddit who are day traders found out that this one hedge fund was shorting a bunch of GameStop stock. And they said, if we can get a bunch of people to buy it, the price will go up. We'll all make a ton of money and the hedge fund will lose billions of dollars. And they got hundreds of thousands of people. It might've been millions. I don't know, to get in on this. And then all of a sudden it, you know, this stock was worth a ton of money. These people, you know, 10 times the value they bought it for. And the hedge fund was out $15 billion. It was going to go under. Then there's this app called Robinhood, which people use to buy the stocks. And they're buddy-buddy with the hedge fund. So they stopped letting people buy stocks, which was cheap.
And the irony is Robinhood is a figure that steals from the rich and gives to the poor. And they and so part of the issue is, and this kind of implicated Mets owner Stephen Cohen to an extent, Citadel and a bunch of other companies are major investors in Robinhood, like 60%. And so the theory, it's again just a theory.
I don't think Robinhood exists anymore, or won't exist by the time this podcast.
Probably not, but which is makes it crazier because they know that, but they're still beholden. The theory is they're still beholden to these companies who invest the most money in it. And so, at the request of these companies, the theory is they halted all buying of GameStop, AMC, you know, Kia, BlackBerry, right, a bunch of other companies. But that you can still sell it. So it's one thing to just freeze it and not be able to you can allow it for you know people to not buy or sell.
And that happens sometimes. Not
it does.
Under these circumstances, but
and that's perfectly legal and you know it's not corrupt. But they're trying to get people to sell this stock so that these companies can continue to make some of their money back at least. And it's pretty much created a cold war between Redditors and hedge fund bros on Wall Street.
So basically what has happened is the hedge funds bought the stock back. The price shot way up. Some people made out, they cashed out and went. And some people are now just saying, screw Wall Street. I'm never going to sell this stock. You'll never get it back. Cause what happens is you can set, you know, you can automatically set it like, don't sell these shares until this price reaches $1,000 a share. For context, it's at like $15 a share right now. And you can say, don't sell these until it reaches $1,000 a share. And people are doing that. And what happens is if the hedge fund can't buy enough shares back to cover how many they borrowed at the current price, they have to start buying the stocks for more than $1,000 to get the price up to $1,000 a share to unlock those shares. So some people think they're going to make millions of dollars off of this. Again, no financial advice. I already cashed out. I made $100. I didn't get my Xbox. I'll get a couple games. That's a win for me. I'll take that. Never going to play stock market again. It's annoying. I don't get how it works outside of this one specific thing. Oh, but were the memes fantastic, Leibowitz? Was the internet content fantastic?
That was great. I mean, it was phenomenal. I mean, this is it's such a wild story. And the internet definitely had a lot of fun with it. And, you know, then you had some really wealthy people, some of which have been implicated in major scandals, coming out and trying to play the moral high ground in this.
Well, how about you mentioned Steve Cohen comes out and says, I'm just trying to make a living.
I think that was a facetious point.
That was a bad joke. That was not the time to make a joke. And then meanwhile, see, you had Jared Porter last week. You Steve Cohen this week. Remember when the Mets were like the national darling? That lasted, what, 2 weeks?
And then you also missed something. Apparently, there might be a scandal with Mickey Callaway coming up, which might, you know, go back to his Mets days.
Well, I don't know. Jeff Passan was on a show last week, and he teased he had a major story coming out the week of the Super Bowl.
Yeah, and I think that might be involving Mickey Callaway. At least I've seen some tweets.
Acting GM, right?
No, Mickey Callaway. No, he was the manager after Terry Collins, and then he didn't last very long. So he's, now I think he might be with the Angels, or I think he's like a bench coach or something with another, or maybe he's the head coach, or the manager, rather.
But it happened, this supposedly happened with the Mets, whatever it is.
I'm not positive on what the allegations are, or what they're rumored to be, but, so it's a bad week for the Mets, bad week for Wall Street. I also have kind of an outside take, because people are cheering this on, and I think everyone cheering this on has no idea about the stock, you know, Wall Street and the stock market at all. And I'm included in that, by the way. I feel like this could lead to a bad trend that's not good for our economy. And yeah, I don't know if that's the case, but I just have a feeling that pumping a lot of money into like a stock for, you know, a company like GameStop or AMC or BlackBerry, like companies that are objectively trending downwards and
so 2000 and late.
Yeah, like I think doing that is not a great thing. And I think that's playing into this make-believe aspect of Wall Street. And I get the argument.
But
that, like,
that's what they want you to think. Like, all the experts were coming on the news all week and saying this is bad, you shouldn't do this, sell the stock. But then everybody kind of realized they were only saying that because the hedge funds wanted them to say that. It wasn't actual advice. What's bad, what I think people have realized this week is what's bad for Wall Street is in some ways good for the average consumer. If we lose one or two hedge funds, but 100 people make $1 million, like everyday people make $1 million, and another million idiots like me come away with $100.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. That's great.
Like, I'll take that.
Yeah, so, and I agree with that. I like the idea of flipping, you know, that hierarchy, the economic hierarchy on its head, especially when, you know, you consider, you mentioned 2008, and there's a lot of predatory shit that goes on Wall Street. And a lot of I mean, that was also involving the real estate bubble, which was predatory loans, but they're all kind of associated with each other, I think. So, yeah, I'm not shedding a tear for these people who are losing money. I'm not, because they've been taking advantage of other companies and other people for a very long time. And this is a win for the little guy. That said, I think that this trend could be dangerous. And I think it also will just lead to more regulations, which, you know, the people, you know, contributing to this on like the Redditor side, I don't think they want that either. So I do worry about the implications. That said, it's fun right now. So let's enjoy for the time being.
I had fun. I did. I'm not going to actually learn the stock market, and like, because my brother does it, and I'm talking to him and he's like, yeah, you put like some money in this, and in like 6 months, like, it might make $10. No, I woke up on Friday, because I put it in Thursday night. Again, this is not financial advice. I woke up, I put it in Thursday at about noon. I woke up on Friday. Before I got out of bed, I'd made $50.
Like, yeah, it's a magic that, Wall Street.
How am I supposed to go back and do penny stocks after that and do like 0.2% margins after that? I'll go watch Wall Street, by the way, is a better movie than Wolf of Wall Street, because that's been discussed this week in relation to all of this.
Wall Street is a better movie?
Than Wolf of Wall Street, yeah.
You know, I've never seen Wall Street. I love Wolf of Wall Street, though.
Wall Street's a very good movie.
I've heard good things, but I feel like Wolf of Wall Street.
Streaming Nowhere, though. I've been trying to watch it because I'm in the mood.
I'll add that to my list.
Definitely, dude, definitely. That's like and like right now, too, is like it's festive.
Mm-hmm.
For lack of a better word.
It's very relevant these days.
But and then the fun part too was because the phrase is to the moon. You take the stock to the moon. So you look on Twitter and there's just all these people who are doing the same thing as you, and they're just going to the moon. And you're like in it with friends, and it was no different than fantasy sports. But again, this felt like not financial advice. This was a sure thing. It's over. I don't have the patience to like actually do Wall Street. I'm done. So.
Yeah. And I get
anyway,
that.
We got to be pushing an hour at this point. If not,
we're well over an hour.
We're well over an hour. All right. So we're going to wrap it up here. New show next week. Super Bowl recap, basketball, hockey, all of it. If that is, I don't strike it big on Wall Street in that time. So follow us on Twitter at Calling It Podcast. Check us out online, clnsmedia.com, under the podcast tab. For Alex Lewis, I'm Alex Barth. Thanks for listening.